You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Taibbi on, everything. Also on the program today, day late but not a dollar short, we're talking about Richard Murdoch, the Senate candidate from Indiana. And just how he exposes, frankly, what I wrote about with Stephen Sherrill in a book almost 7 years ago, where the mainstream of the Republican Party is. Somewhere back, 1900s, in terms of women as chattel, maybe earlier, I'm not sure. President Obama, in his off-the-record, back-on-the-record interview with the Des Moines Register, gives more indication of a grand bargain. I know, folks. I know. If I talk about the grand bargain, Mitt Romney will win. Well, sorry. I don't think that's the case. And probably the same for the disposition matrix. Like a board game. Think of it as a board game. Think of it as, instead of do not pass go, do not collect $200 or whatever it is. Think of it as like Candyland. I don't know if you played Candyland recently. I have. In fact, it's the only board game I've been playing for what feels like 5 years. My daughter, even though she's 7, has not quite progressed in the board game world. And you get you move up chutes and ladders, for that matter. And you work your way up through a matrix so that you can get on a kill list. I mean, you don't try to do that, but that's what happens. A whistleblower sentenced to 2 years in prison. John Kirchhoff. I'll get to the details of that story later in the program. And Colin Powell, is there anything more incorrect about this country than the fact that we still care what Colin Powell thinks? Because the reality is that Colin Powell endorsing President Obama will probably make some small marginal difference somewhere with some people. But really, I mean, this is a guy who took his vast amount of credibility that he had built up with the American public. We can argue as to whether or not that was deserved in the first place. I don't know that he had such a great record in Vietnam, but let's not go there. Who who took that credibility that he had with the American public, went in front of the UN, in which he later, very bravely, 4 years later, I think it was, or 3 years later, 5 years later, sent out his number two man to say that it was the worst day of Colin Powell's life or his career. When he went in front of the UN, held up a little bottle of jock itch powder and said, "This is the proof." I mean, metaphorically speaking. But here are some pictures of some ice cream delivery trucks that could be mobile biolabs. And we have absolute proof of this. Small asterisk. Tiny asterisk. Check later for fine print. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lied to the American public. Lied to the international community. Now, of course, he claims he was lied to. Which doesn't make him a very bright guy, does it? Because he supposedly had access to all the documents that none of us supposedly had access to. And that even the Clinton administration, I guess, despite the fact that they knew that Curveball, who has since come out and said he lied, was lying at the time. So somehow Colin Powell still has sway. And what a bold endorsement coming 8 days out from the election when every indication is that President Obama is going to win. What a bold, brave man. It's nauseating to me that I have to objectively say this is news, because it is. Because it does impact some people's voting decision more so than, I don't know who else could have come out and endorsed. I guess if Clint Eastwood now finally came out and endorsed President Obama, that would also be news. But it's sad that the tremendous lack of accountability that exists for those people who led this country into an invasion and occupation, illegal invasion and occupation of another country, killing by the most conservative accounts of our own U.S. government over 100,000 innocent civilians, causing the displacement of over 4 million people, 2 million internally, 2 million refugees going outside of the country. Who knows how much death and destruction that still exists in that country because of what we did. And the destabilization, who knows how much it'll go in the future with, you know, President Romney attacking Iran. Not to mention the near 5,000 servicemen who died in Iraq. Who knows how many more died in Afghanistan, both innocents and not, because of our failure to deal with our other war in Afghanistan because of our invasion of Iraq. Who knows if the drone program would even be where it is today had we simply done what we originally said we were going to do in Afghanistan. Remember, we're not going to leave it. We're not going to make the mistake that we're not going to leave it like we did last time. We're going to rebuild this country and bring it into the modern era. So as despicable as the rest of that crew in the Bush administration was, Colin Powell, in some respects, is made more despicable by the fact that he really somehow escape that debacle with any reputation intact, enough so that his endorsement is considered a benefit for President Obama. Where's Paul Wolfowitz? So, I don't know. That's that. Man, I was in a good mood 11 minutes ago. I don't know what happened. All right, we'll get to the Murdoch stuff after the interview with Matt Taibbi. I recorded this interview with Taibbi yesterday. A couple of house cleaning things I'd like to tell you about. Jay from Best of the Left has emailed me. Best of the Left is a, I think it's the most successful podcast out there. He calls clips from different shows, often clips this show, and was when I launched this, was sort of on a one-to-one basis, just incredibly generous with his support of my launching this show and his advice and help. And apparently, and probably only because we were not aware that Stitcher was giving out awards, or otherwise this wouldn't have been working out this way for him. But Best of the Left is a finalist for a Stitcher award, and we'll put the link on the site. Go over there and win it for Best of the Left, because it's the closest thing you could do to voting for us for that award, because he features the show on there occasionally. So go give him a vote. We'll put the link on the blog at majority.fm. Also want to just say back to those people who sent us emails, about the members content yesterday, the interview, the archived interview with the filmmaker of One Bright Shining Moment, the story of McGovern. I want to thank you for the emails, thanking us for giving you that extra member content. So your members, you deserve it. And also, I got one complaint that we have not posted yet. The thing from Monday night, which we will today. Remind me, Matt, I have it. And that complaint, of course, came from my sister. So my sister sends like, and it was a completely impersonal.
No, there were a few more people.
Oh, were there?
Yeah.
Oh.
And right. I sent you an email too.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well, the one that I saw was my sister going like, but you said you were going to post that. Now, she didn't, obviously it was an email, so that was not the voice that she used, but I could hear that's what the voice was. So yes, Julie, we will post that. And I wanted one more programming note. Tonight, I am debating, and we will put the link up on the blog, at 9:30 Eastern through a YouTube channel called Polypop. I'm debating a guy named Stéphane Melieu. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Don't mean not to. Who is, you know, that in the better half of the program, I take a lot of phone calls from libertarians and or self-identified libertarians, to be generous. Because apparently every time a libertarian calls in, so they always say, those other guys who called in were not libertarians. And I believe them. Maybe I've never talked to a libertarian. And more often than not, they're not. I mean, I want to just put this fairly. They're not bright. And they make fools of themselves.
The one thing that remains constant with all those other people you've talked to is that they all say you should debate this guy tonight.
Well,
so he definitely must be a libertarian.
That is the one thing, is that we post some of these on YouTube, and apparently there is a very prominent libertarian YouTube philosopher or espouser, and every time we get back, you why don't you debate Stéphane Melieu? And
what are you scared, Sam?
Yeah, and it's always like Jacques. And so the opportunity has come up tonight at 9:30. It's going to be an hour and a half debate. This guy is, I mean, I've seen some videos of his. He's a bright guy, very well spoken. It should be incredibly interesting. We have been, you know, going back and forth a little bit through the Polypop people on email. And at one point, the Polypop people were like, okay, I think we could probably just, I think there's going to be plenty to talk about.
You know, like at one point, they actually had to moderate the pre-debate emails. And so I think you're going to want to check this out. And if you're a member of the program, of course, we will provide that audio for you in the days to come. So not to worry. Tomorrow, also another house cleaning. Tomorrow will be fresh content. Cliff Schechter and Matthew Film Guy. All right, so here's the interview that I did with Matt Taibbi yesterday. It's a good one, actually, very interesting. He talks about his experiences in Russia and how they sadly provided some type of framework for him to see what was happening here when it comes to oligarchs. I know we had talked about, I think, Krista Freeland being on the program today. She was overbooked, but Matt just came off of an interview with her, so we will have her in the days to come. We'll be back after, well, we'll take a break, and then Matt Taibbi. Back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the author of Griftopia, Spanking the Donkey, the Great Derangement, and of course a contributing writer to Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi. Is that it? Did I get your title right? Contributing writer?
Yeah, I don't even know what my title. I think it's contributing editor. I'm not sure.
Contributing editor. Let's just say publisher for the time being.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds good.
So, speaking of Rolling Stone, I mean, I want to get to the debate, and I also want to talk about the conversation that you had on Bill Moyers with Christopher Freeland. But apparently, my understanding is that President Obama basically called you on the carpet. Is that right?
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. We, you know, we did our magazine did an in-depth interview with President Obama, and they asked him a question about financial reform, and in it he says, yeah, I've looked at some of Rolling Stone's articles, and they say this didn't go far enough, and we didn't reinstitute Glass-Steagall, and so forth, but I don't agree with that. And he basically says the reason that they didn't reinstitute Glass-Steagall is because there's no evidence that the Glass-Steagall Act repeal caused the financial crash, and the evidence for that is that Lehman Brothers, Glass-Steagall, just to back up, Glass-Steagall made it legal to merge investment banks, commercial banks, and insurance companies, creating companies like Citigroup.
And in fact, Citigroup merged at first, and then essentially,
right, and then they did, yeah,
and then
they made it legal,
and then they made it legal as part of, I think it was the
Graham Leach Bliley Act,
and yeah. And of course Robert Rubin was one of the chief advisors to the to President Clinton at that time. And then of course Robert Rubin ended up getting, just coincidentally, a job at that new company that was created
where he made $120 million or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure, listen, it's not easy to take that elevator up to that that top floor every day. I mean, it's exhausting. You get your ears pop every time, probably.
Exactly.
So his
point is that he basically says Lehman Brothers isn't one of those companies. You know, so the repeal of Glass-Steagall created what they call these supermarket financial firms, right? That, you know, it's one-stop shopping. You can do insurance, commercial banking, investment banking. So he said Lehman Brothers wasn't a supermarket firm. Therefore, Glass-Steagall had nothing to do with the financial crisis. So it's a strange argument. It overlooks a couple of things. I mean, it's true that Lehman Brothers was just an investment bank, but a bunch of those companies that were created by Glass-Steagall collapsed in 2008, or they would have gone out of business without massive bailouts. You know, including Citigroup. Citigroup was the single largest recipient of bailout money. It got almost $500 billion in cash and guarantees. So it's a weird thing. I mean, we never really said, actually, in our articles that Obama should have reinstated Glass-Steagall. What we really said was it was kind of a shame that he supported, you know, the new version of that, which is the Volcker Rule, and then sort of behind closed doors, his own administration punched holes in it, and that kind of sucked, and among other things.
With Lehman Brothers is, I mean, Lehman Brothers ended up basically going bankrupt. As far as I know, there still could be guys, you know, in some building on Madison Avenue right now, still unwinding it. They certainly were for a couple of years. And
sure. The
issue was not so much Lehman Brothers, but the anticipated cascading of all these other institutions, and the implications of that was what this was all about. I mean, if it was just in some way that you could have put Lehman Brothers in some type of
like a bubble, yeah.
Yeah, in some type of bubble, if it was some way to sequester Lehman Brothers, then theoretically there wouldn't have been this sort of nightmare scenario that we were all told about.
No, yeah. Clearly, the issue wasn't just one or two investment banks. There were a number of problems, but the biggest problem was we had created this atmosphere where we had all these huge, gigantic companies that were too big to fail, and they were all totally interconnected with each other. And in addition to that, they had all been allowed to borrow way beyond their means, because we lifted all these leverage requirements, these reserve requirements that they used to have. So now they, you know, a company like Lehman or Bear Stearns could borrow $40 for every dollar it actually had, where that wasn't actually true. So not only are they like more concentrated, they're bigger, you know, they're the federally insured banking institutions like, you know, Citibank are now connected to investment banks like, you know, Salomon Smith Barney. It's just a combination of all these factors. It's not just Glass-Steagall. It's the lifting of leverage requirements, deregulation of derivatives. I mean, it's complicated. It's just to simplify it and you know, reduce it to one thing like that. It's just odd.
I mean, I think it's a classic straw man argument. I mean,
right.
You know, one doesn't know if Glass-Steagall would have prevented it, but it certainly would have gone at least in some direction. And of course, you know, Glass-Steagall was sort of the last vestige of those reforms that were put in following the financial crisis during the Great Depression, that were to protect consumers and, frankly, to protect the banking system. So it may be the case that Glass-Steagall in and of itself, by the time that it was repealed, was a shell of its former self in some respects. But it is a weird construct. And it's also strange because it shows a certain sensitivity. I mean, you could have, or defensiveness. I mean, you could have answered that question like, look, we did the best that we could with the constraints that we had. I am president. I can suggest certain things and I can push certain things and I can advocate for certain things, but I cannot, force people to vote. It is still simply just a full-throated defense of, I guess, the idea that there's not much that we can do.
Right, yeah. It's just odd. I think he's sensitive to criticism that comes from, what he perceives to be his base for, anything that he does. And I think, especially at this time when he's under so much pressure and he's in this election that he might lose, and it might turn out that any little thing might cost him the election, and he's probably sensitive right now to the idea that somebody who should be sympathetic to him gave him a hard time about
it was,
about something, something that he doesn't feel all that strongly about. Maybe, I don't know. I'm sort of grasping at straws to try to figure out where this really came from.
Now, were you in the room for that interview?
No, I was not. No, they never let me near the president.
That was one of the stipulations, right? That Taibbi better be out of state when we
exactly, two states away.
Now, of course, the one of the things that was interesting in the context of the debates, and at this point they've all sort of melded into one debate in my mind. But at one point, Mitt Romney sort of did attack Dodd-Frank from the left, which was interesting, rather hard to believe, because,
remind me, what did he say? I can't remember.
Well, he said something like it didn't go far enough or wasn't effective. Mitt Romney is, you can argue that President Obama did not effectively address the problem in terms of what's going to happen in the future. Mitt Romney is the embodiment of the problem, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's a really strange thing for him to say, because I've never heard him say anything like that before. He campaigns on the idea that Obama is the enemy of business and that he's created regulations that have crippled, the engines that drive society and all that. So I don't know where that's coming from. I mean, clearly it was part of his whole debate strategy to kind of move, to run around kind of Bugs Bunny style, in the blink of an eye to rush around to Obama's other side and attack him from the left, and, look like a centrist good guy. But that's a really strange issue for him to take that strategy with, because he's just never been that guy. He's always been anti-regulation.
Yeah, I think you had a piece up, that you blogged, a week or two ago, saying that basically Romney has been unleashed, and it's just a cavalcade, like a cascading of bullcrap that has now emanated from him. And I think that's a fairly
kind of beautiful to watch, actually. I mean, it's just like watching a child, a confused teenager, sort of blossom into a full grown adult. I mean, he's like self actualizing before our eyes. It's kind of cool.
Well, there was some expectation.
It wasn't so disturbing, but yeah.
Expectation that he was going to do this from the beginning, and I'm not convinced that had he not done it from the beginning. I mean, I we're a week out from the election now, a week and a half. Still quite convinced that Mitt Romney is going to lose. And I'm also not convinced that had Mitt Romney, he had to tack to crazy town to get through those Republican primaries. But of course, the biggest threat to him during those Republican primaries, in my estimation, was the attacks on him as a vulture capitalist by Newt Gingrich. And he never... He took a long time to sort of swing to the center, as it were.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, who can fathom it? But I do think that this is his strong suit. He's a closer. He's a salesman. You know, you can kind of see where his success in business came from. He's the guy you just put in a room and he stays in there with whoever he's in the meeting with until the deal gets done. And you can imagine him as the guy who'll just say anything to make sure that he gets those signatures on the paper. And that's who he is, I think. And he's really good at it. So it's coming out now.
And, we're talking about sort of the 1%. I mean, literally, I want to talk about the, I haven't seen all of it because I don't think it's all quite up. I think it's happening this weekend, maybe. But you were interviewed by Bill Moyers with Chrystia Freeland, who we're going to have on this program. We were going to have her on by one of these days, but she's incredibly overbooked at this point. But,
right.
Talk about that conversation, because it was, you know, regardless of what happens with this election, I think we're going to have a lot more problems, obviously, if it's Mitt Romney, but we're still going to be faced with sort of some fundamental problems that are systemic in our society that are not going to go away regardless of who's the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was a really interesting conversation. Chrystia has written a new book called Plutocrats, which I think is the subhead is like the rise of the global super elite and the fall of everyone else. And it's a subject. I'm actually writing a book kind of on the same subject, which is sort of about how, you know, the rules for people at the very, very top are in one direction, and then the rules for everybody else are sort of rapidly declining in a different direction, and we're creating this schism in society that is just getting bigger at an exponential rate. And so we talked for, you know, a good long while about that subject, and it was interesting, I think, for both of us, because we actually knew each other years ago when we both lived in Russia in the 90s. We were both reporters there, and we saw kind of like a sneak preview of this whole phenomenon when communism ended in Russia, and there was instantaneously this incredible divide in the Russian society, where there were like 8 people who had all the money, and then everybody else had nothing. I think that experience kind of shaped both of us. It's definitely shaped my view of how to perceive politics these days, because I just see so many of the same tendencies happening now, and I think she does too.
Let's talk about those tendencies, because I've always wondered that, because you did you. I mean, I'm sure there have been times in history where that sort of that phenomenon, like sort of the instant oligarchies, like a complete complete divestment from the prior sort of structure into a new one that immediately just became these sort of crazy oligarchies, I guess, where, ruled by oligarchs and, you know, semi-criminal oligarchs, or I don't know if there's any other type, but some were, I guess, more criminal than others.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But speak more about that experience, and specifically, I'm curious what things you saw there that when you came back to the States and started writing about politics, what you noticed in terms of similarities here. And I'm curious is if they were here when you got back, those road signs, and you didn't see them, or they were still sort of developing. In other words, you know, was it what changed?
I didn't see when I came back from Russia. I never expected to be covering like the same story again. I mean, when I came back to the States in 2001, I guess, or 2002, I was completely not prepared to look at American politics and see really the same phenomena repeating themselves. It was such a unique situation in Russia in the 90s that it's just the idea that there would be a pattern there that would be repeated anywhere else was not something that I had expected. And we spent a lot of the time in the 90s, a lot of what that story was about privatization. So you had this completely state-run economy, and how do you make it, how do you privatize it, how do you make it a capitalist economy? And the way they did it was completely unfair. They essentially arranged it so that a whole bunch of, you know, a small group of buddies of Boris Yeltsin and his cronies, they rigged all these auctions so that these guys could win some of the world's biggest metals and aluminum and oil and gas companies. And so that's how you got this instant oligarchy. You had state-run companies like Gazprom and Yukos, which were, you know, essentially the Russian versions of, you know, Exxon or Mobil or companies like that. And you just handed them to single individuals, and they became the richest people on the planet, like overnight. But that phenomenon, you know, if you look at what happened in 2008, where you had a very, very small group of bankers and financiers here in the States, who had politically supported both parties, got massive state bailouts, and not only did they get state bailouts, but they got funding to increase the size of their empire. So if you look at companies like Wells Fargo and Chase, they were given bailouts that allowed them to buy companies like Wachovia and Washington Mutual. And it was a very similar process. It was, you know, a small group of financial oligarchs were essentially given taxpayer money to become even bigger oligarchs. And it was shocking to me in 2008 when I started to see that same kind of stuff happen. And that was freaky, definitely. For all of us,
and so after, I mean, just take us through in Russia a little bit to see if there's anything that can be learned. I mean, after the spoils, I guess, of this move to privatization were sort of cemented, what then happens, right? Once you've hit that tipping point, it's almost now becomes the inertia of that, it seems to me, sort of continues to create the same dynamic.
Yeah, and the first thing that happened was the instance they did that, all of these state-run mechanisms that previously had gone to supporting, you know, what the Soviet version of the middle class would be, you know, the free education, free healthcare, you know, the union benefits, the union-run vacations, the state-aided travel vouchers and things like that—they all disappeared. That was kind of the secondary consequence. As soon as they created this class of rich people, there was suddenly this whole new infrastructure for schools and for medicine that was completely private and really only catered to people who had the money to pay for it. And so suddenly you were left with this vast underclass. That had no access to education, heating, medicine, all of these, you know, would-be life necessities. They were just completely left out in the dark. And you know, we can see that same kind of thing happening on a much, much smaller scale here in the States. But, you know, we have a very divided society where it's true what they say. America has the best medical system in the world, except, you know, but it's for the people who can afford it and who have insurance, and, you know, and that's kind of the system that we have. We're looking at the same kinds of tendencies now.
And from a popular opinion perspective, was there? I mean, because the dynamic we have, of course, in this country is that there is a substantial apparatus in which to deal, to almost like short circuit
any type of movement that would bring this dynamic to the fore. And you know, so I'm talking like whatever it's social issues or or other such issues, which sort of, you know, the identity politics, which prevent, you know, sort of a genuine congealing. You know, there was an attempt, obviously, with Occupy, and I imagine we're going to see more of that in the months and years to come. But there's the system in some ways is set up to sort of prevent that type of popular uprising here in Russia. What have they? Was there a rise in sort of like social issues? I mean, you know, to the extent that we can understand them, or?
Well, the thing in Russia was that, you know, any kind of instinct or move toward a popular revolt against any of this, you know, they had the additional tool of using force to suppress it whenever they wanted to. You know, for example, I covered for a while this problem that was going on in the Arctic where coal miners were just not getting paid. They would just not pay miners for 6, 7, 8 months at a time, and the guys were basically living off of these daily food rations that the company was handing out. And anytime any union leader tried to do anything, you know, to organize these guys or to get them to walk out on the job, you know, that union leader would be found, you know, with a bullet in his head and a pile of coal in front of the mine, you know, or anytime any reporter, you know, who worked for a newspaper, in Moscow, you know, tried to publish something that he didn't have organized crime permission to publish, you know, he would mysteriously, be blown up by an exploding briefcase it's a caricature of what we're dealing with here in the States. I mean, the problems in Russia were, you know, cartoonized. So you had gangsterism merging with the state. If there was any legitimate political candidate, he was either, you know, rubbed out or he was participated in an election which, you know, the other side just blatantly stole. And you know, that's the reality. There were no avenues for protest that were not dangerous and extremely likely to unsucceed in Russia in the 90s. Once this whole class of people coalesced all their money and power and figured out how they were going to operate, there was really no room for ordinary people to move anymore.
And that it's still things have really not progressed any further.
No, but you know, again, it's hard to compare the two things because Russia's history has always been, you know, the country has always been kind of despotic in nature, I hate to say this, but it's kind of in the blood of you know, the Russian people in a way. You know, I think they struggle with it, but it's you know, whether it wasn't a surprise that, you know, czarism progressed to, like, you know, an exaggerated form of the same kind of despotism under communism. And then when communism ended, you return back to, you know, a system that's very much like czarism. It just seems to be what that country, that's the form of government they always end up with.
Yeah. And of course, speaking of czarism, in this country, we have this, I guess, this sort of, I don't know. I just feel like, you know, you know, again, getting back to our election, which is coming up in a week and a half, we're looking at a choice between the sort of the status quo and worse than the status quo from the perspective.
Right.
And I still am. There are. I guess there are just sort of broader forces in this country that we have a systemic problem that both
creates a less of an like a, I guess, a stark dynamic like you see what happened in Russia. And I imagine the rate of disparity is also sort of like mitigated, or the speed of the rate of disparity or growth of disparity is mitigated by the structures that we have in place in this country. But it also, they sort of function to act against any real awareness of what's going on. I mean, I'm just thinking, because I got, my sister forwarded to me an email this morning from someone we both know who was just sort of a vehement opponent of President Obama's. But it's all on this whole thing of, like, you know, like literally it's almost a graph that I'm sure we could find in Christian's book, maybe your book, you know, a quote that we've seen from one of those pieces of how billionaires are upset. This guy's not a billionaire. He does quite well. But it's, he's got like, as a business owner and an entrepreneur, I can tell you that the current environment has us reducing expenses and overhead, and definitely has us looking to do more with less, i.e. less employees. And this is such a fantasy that it is a function of somehow regulation, or that somehow we're in a government induced bad business climate. Let's put it that way.
I mean, it's just totally irrational. And I think Christia really talked about that in the show, that a lot of this is just, it's an emotional thing with a lot of these big business owners. They're offended. They have hurt feelings, basically, that they've occasionally been criticized. You know, there's an incredible passage in her book that talks about how they don't even like the word rich anymore. They think it's disparaging. And they prefer the term affluent. The think tanks that are funded by wealthy individuals in this country, they're allowed to investigate issues like poverty, but they're not allowed to do it when you compare it to affluence, because it raises questions about the legitimacy of their wealth, you know, and so nobody likes to go near that topic. And whenever anybody does, even when they criticize it in the most mild way possible, which is like what Obama's done, where he's occasionally used words like fat cats, that's enough to send these people into a tizzy where they think that they're being assaulted and attacked. It's just like a psychological thing, you know, they're paranoid, like they're narcissists. They interpret the slightest, absence of worship, as an attack. And I think that's what we're seeing here. They're being ridiculously oversensitive.
I mean, this is the thing that I think, you know, you mentioned about Romney, being a guy who can get into a room and I think it and close the deal. And there's been a couple occasions in my life, sometimes odd circumstances where I've been in those rooms. I have been with the, I've either been there as a third party that was just sort of like mistakenly allowed into the room, or as, one of those people who are ostensibly on the sales team. And I've just stood there with just complete wonder that it's, that in some ways that these decisions, which involve so much money, happen so, like so much of it is whimsy. You know, I mean, I think there's a perception, and, you know, I think one of the things that as I've spent now almost 10 years sort of like so deeply immersed in politics and have come to know people who are in these rooms where certain conversations are happening, that I am just shocked at the level of, the lack of some other higher level of sophistication that one would presume is going on when you talk about decisions that involve millions of people's lives or hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's just not there. It's just basically like, you know, the worst high school experiences you've ever had. It's just if the stakes are just much higher.
Yeah, no, I always come back to you using the movie All the President's Men, right?
Uh-huh.
You know that scene where Redford is talking to, or Woodward is talking to Deep Throat in the garage, and there's this great scene where he's talking about Nixon and all of his henchmen and everything, and Deep Throat says, the thing you have to keep in mind is, you know, these guys aren't very smart. And I think that's something that you have to, people don't totally understand about a lot of these sort of Wall Street plutocrat types, is that, you know, they're clever, and they know how their world works, and they know how to, you know, a lot about a very narrow set of, you know, variables, but they can be completely clueless about the rest of the world, and emotionally immature too. They just don't, they live in a really small bubble where they don't have to interact with people who aren't like themselves, and that just makes them, you know, not terribly bright, and unable to see the world for the way it really is. And I think that's very different from the image that is presented in the media, where they're presented as these guys who are incredibly successful and all-knowing and have all the answers, but they don't really have all the answers. They're you know, they have the answers for how they rose up in their own particular fields, but that's really about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that is just so surprising, I think, and hard for people to grasp, is that you can obtain a lot of power and a lot of wealth, even if you're just not particularly bright. I mean, obviously, you need to be able to find your way, you know, out of your house every day, and you need to be able to tie your shoes. But
right.
And I think, you know, to a certain extent, to the extent that we have any type of hope in that there will not be a sort of and maybe, you know, maybe we've already crossed certain thresholds, but there are limits on the power of these people. I think it is that fact right there, is that there's also not the self-correcting mechanism. I can correct, you know, if somebody works for me, I'm much more apt to correct their, to speak up about what I perceive as their misperceptions than I am the person who funds me. Now,
right.
Sadly, in my case specifically, there isn't necessarily that person who funds me, but hope springs eternal. But that is, you know, when that whole the guy who owns the Chicago Cubs, when there was that memo leaked about what he was planning to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on this campaign to prove that President Obama wasn't born in this country or whatever it was, that's mm-hmm. the only thing that occurred to me, was like, this billionaire money is really stupid. And there's a
right.
lot of people who are probably even somewhat smarter who are trying to extract that money from that person, and will never say, like, hey, no, actually, if you really want to unseat President Obama, what you should be doing is making the case that whatever, that there needs to be broader.
You should be funding my think tank. Yeah.
It's no, we'll, yeah, give me, that's exactly the ad. We're going to blow the whole lid off this vetting thing, and it's going to cost you a lot of money. And of course, you got to spend money to make money. And
right.
that's the way these people are separated from their cash.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. But the I mean, the problem is, you know, at least on Wall Street, I mean, you have some of these guys really are, you know, not just not terribly bright, but like beyond stupid, you know, like, you know, Dick Fuld, the guy who ran Lehman Brothers, for instance, was just a complete and utter moron. I mean, he wasn't just incompetent. He couldn't see any angles at all. When presented with overwhelming evidence that investing in mortgage-backed securities was going to lead to certain doom for his company, like within the next, you know, few hours or something like that, he doubled down on the whole thing immediately. Like, that was his response. He was a contrarian. He just trusted his own instincts, and he drove his company into, you know, a $100 billion loss. But the problem is, with these guys, is that normally their own stupidity should be a limiting factor, but most of them, when they screw up, now there are all these devices in place where we bail it out, and they either stay in place or somebody like them, you know, replaces them, and that's kind of the problem. And if if only we had a system where we allowed really, really dumb people to fail, that would be all right. But you know, Lehman Brothers is the exception. The rule in this world is that the stupid tend to survive, which is just kind of a drag.
And basically, the skill set you need to know is how to work your way through a corporation or a business, which isn't necessarily. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems I think that we have in this country, and you can see it in the context of how non-financial corporations have become financial instruments in many respects, is that the shortest distance between one of these guys and success is to bypass the interests of the long-term health of a corporation and the long-term health of its base of demand, you know, its customers, and pursue strategies that either catapult them to the top of one of these companies or simply allow them to bilk the company out of a ton of cash and then right. exit with their stock options that they can then redeem before the whole house of cards falls.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, that's how did Dick Fuld remain the CEO of Lehman Brothers for, you know, years longer than he should have? Well, one of the ways he did it is he used phony accounting to make, you know, to magically invent $50 billion in sales every quarter through an accounting trick that, you know, was later deemed to be illegal. Is that a skill set? You know, is that something that he brought to the table, or was that just, you know, dishonesty that gave him a temporary advantage over somebody who would have been better at the job? That kind of short-term thinking and short-term their corporate terrains, the problem is that those guys who are taking those shortcuts, they're staying in place, they're succeeding, and there's no mechanism to kind of let them fail and let them work their way out of the system right now, which is the problem.
It is at least one of the problems.
Right.
Matt Taibbi, thanks so much for spending some time with us. We'll talk to you soon, and looking forward to your new book and watching that Bill Moyers special, which I think people check your local listings, PBS.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And also check out Taibbi blog for the skinny on the Bill Moyers Bill O'Reilly showdown. It's almost grotesque to even use those same two names in the same sentence, but it is what it is. Matt, thanks again for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Sam. We'll talk to you soon, man.
All right. We are back. That was my interview with Matt Taibbi. And folks, you can support this program by becoming a member. I say this every day. Yesterday, it didn't seem to work. Oh, well, I guess yesterday was a pre-tape. Maybe that's what it is. Now that today I'm live, please become a member at majority.fm. You can also support the show by giving us a good review on iTunes, buying your coffee, tea, or chocolate fair trade at justcoffee.coop. Get a 10% discount coupon with the word majority, or buy some Majority Report blend coffee. How's that? Have some folks over. Maybe you're having a dinner party. Maybe you're having a brunch. You serve Majority FM coffee. They go, hey, what's this? I've never heard of this. And then you slowly say, well, there's a guy who goes on and he starts talking about politics. I can't imagine there's a single time that scenario has ever happened. Wow, this is great coffee. Well, this is the podcast I listen to. I don't know.
If they sell great coffee, they must have great politics too.
Well, nevertheless, folks, if that has ever happened, please send me an email because I'd like to hear about it. You can also support this show by liking us on Facebook, by signing up for our emails at majority.fm down at the bottom. You can
follow us on Twitter.
Follow us on Twitter.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Leave us a review on iTunes.
I said that.
Okay.
But becoming a member is really the way that this show continues on. And we'll talk more about it later. And also, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, you can buy it through our Amazon link. You will not know the difference, but we get a little kickback. Just go to majority.fm/support the show. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap there. Coming up in the better half, going to be talking about this disposition matrix. It sounds so antiseptic. You just don't want to be on it. And
there's a little bit of the debate in the
whistleblower who basically revealed, in some respects, that the Bush administration was torturing people, or one of those people are coming out and criticizing it, at least, now sentenced, has accepted a plea agreement, now going to jail for 2 years. Also in the better half, we'll be talking about Richard Murdoch and just how reprehensible. Now, maybe we may have to amend this because John McCain has given him his blessing. So forget it. All right, folks, see you in the better half.